Thank you for those very kind words, John, His Excellency the Governor, Mrs. Skirse, some other friends, Professor Thomas, of course, and Lowitja herself, and ladies and gentlemen. Well, only Lowitja would put me after Deborah Cheatham. She's a hard girl, that Lowitja. She always makes you earn your freight. Always. And let me say, and I hope Deborah doesn't regard this as being in any way out of place, but if those songs were sung tonight by Leontine Price or Jesse Norman, we couldn't have been more proud than what we heard from her. And it just shows you, of course, you know, someone said, Herr Mahler, what do you think of Mr. Puccini's work? And he said, well, he can write some simple tunes. And of course, while Deborah didn't sing any Mahler, she sang, of course, the next best thing, and that's, of course, Strauss. And you can see how the German language just works so well when it's sung. Sung. At any rate, thank you, Deborah, for a wonderful performance. Thank you for coming, both of you. Well, of course, it's a great honour to be asked by the Don Dunstan Foundation to deliver this oration in Lowitja O'Donoghue's name. Of course, I knew Don Dunstan, but not really well. But I admired him for his ability to see through the conservative orthodoxy, social orthodoxy of the time, which had become part and parcel of Australia, and of course no less so here in Adelaide. Don Dunstan used the premiership of South Australia to challenge elements of that orthodoxy, so I'm pleased to be associated with his spirit and this foundation in his name. And well may it be the case that Don Dunstan's progressive instincts, reflected in the foundation's remit, should sponsor an oration in the name of another South Australian progressive, of course, Lowitja O'Donoghue. I've accepted this opportunity of delivering the Lowitja O'Donoghue oration for one primary reason, out of respect for Lowitja O'Donoghue as a remarkable Australian leader. A leader whose unfailing instinct for enlargement marks her out as unique. And unique for this reason, when a great opportunity in history, the history of the Aboriginal people and the largely European population of Australia presented itself, Lowitja O'Donoghue saw that opportunity with great clarity and unilaterally moved to seize it. The opportunity was the willingness of the Labor government I led to legislatively validate and develop the decision of the High Court of Australia in Queensland versus Mabo 1992, today known as Mabo Number 2. Without any position of mandated authority from her people, she caused their mobilisation in what was, for the first time, that Aboriginal people were brought fully and in an equal way to the centre of national executive power. In the 204 history of the formerly colonised Australia, this had never happened. Never before had the Commonwealth Government of Australia and its cabinet, nor any earlier colonial government, laid out a basis of consultation and negotiation offering full participation to the country's Indigenous representatives. And certainly not around such a matter as the country's common law, where something as significant as native title rights could arise from a collection of laws which had themselves developed from, as we know, European custom and tradition. The High Court of Australia had opened the door to this possibility in Mabo No. 2, but without a comprehensive, firm and quick legislative response, that door would have just as quickly closed. Most of the states of Australia had adopted a defensive posture to the opportunity of Mabo, while Western Australia would have moved to extinguish whatever native title rights were revealed by the High Court's historic judgment, as in fact Western Australia tried to do. Lowitja Ononishu understood this. She knew that in the dismal history of Indigenous relations with European Australia, this was an illuminated breakout, a comet of light in an otherwise darkened landscape. Now, of course, many people here tonight will know the history, or some of it. They will know that no one person or group of persons was ever mandated to assume the authority of or to act on behalf of the whole Indigenous community. They will know that attempts to so act were often met with reaction and derision. They will know there was no premium for assuming or even attempting to assume such a mantle of leadership. They will also know that in respect of the Keating government's first offers of consultation around the issue of a proposed Native Title Act, that many Aboriginal leaders rejected the entreaties of the government out of hand. They will remember the meetings at Eva Valley and Boomanella Oval in Canberra. They will remember the rancour. They will also remember me saying as Prime Minister, I doubted whether Indigenous leaders would ever psychologically make the change to come into a process, to be part of it, and to take the burden of responsibility which went with that, whether they could ever summon the authority of their own community to negotiate for and on their own behalf. I like to think those remarks helped galvanise Lowitja Donohue's view as what needed to be done. But as it turned out, only she could do it. She was the chair of ATSIC. This gave her a pulpit to speak from, but no overarching authority, much less power. But this is where leadership matters. She decided, alone decided, that the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples of Australia would negotiate, and I emphasise negotiate, with the Commonwealth Government of Australia, and that the negotiators would be the leaders of the Indigenous land councils. She decided that. And from that moment, for the first time in the 204 history of the settled country, its Indigenous people sat in full concert with the government of it all. This is why I'm here tonight, to acknowledge that moment of leadership and to celebrate it. Of course, Lowitja would say, and she had helpers. Principal among them was David Ross, a director of the Central Land Council, a leader in his own right and a weighty judge of circumstances. She had Peter Yu from the Kimberley Land Council. She had Rob Riley from the Legal Service of Western Australia, Noel Pearson from the Cape York Land Council, and Gaetano Lui from the Island Coordinating Council. And in those early stages, important early stages, she had the support and advice of Pat and Mick Dodson, Chair of the Council of Aboriginal Reconciliation and Social Justice Commissioner, respectively. And she had others who came into the process a little later, Darryl Cronin from the Kimberley Land Council, who effectively became secretary to the negotiating group, Darryl Pearce from the Northern Land Council, and Marcia Langton, who fulfilled an important general advisory role. Indeed, these people, or most of them, also attended with Lowitja the first Mabo ministerial meeting, which I chaired as Prime Minister in the Cabinet Room, Canberra, on 27 April 1993. Had Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders not stepped up to the plate, the substance and equity of the subsequent Native Title Act may never have materialised. In an instant, I was struck by the opportunity of the High Court decision and was determined not to see it slaked away in legislative neglect. But determined as I was, I needed the partnership with Indigenous leaders to get it done, but importantly, to get it done fairly. We know, sadly, that the history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land rights has been broadly a shameful one. Not only from earlier High Court decisions implying that all native title rights to land were extinguished at sovereignty, but by unfulfilled promises by a clutch of otherwise well-meaning governments. Say for Don Dunstan's Act in 1966 and Gough Whitlam's Northern Territory Land Rights Bill of 1975, passed into law by Malcolm Fraser in 1976, which was of course confined to Northern Territory lands, there had been no exercise of the power under the 1967 constitutional amendment by the Commonwealth in favour of comprehensive land rights. In 1983, the Hawke government promised a national land rights bill, which included an inalienable freehold title and compensation for past acts and alienations. But this promise of uniform national land rights was broken in March 1986, when Bob Hawke buckled to pressure applied by the then Labor Premier of Western Australia, Brian Burke, in concert with his federal factional colleague, Senator Graham Richardson. What Burke promised in substitute for Commonwealth national land rights was to provide Aboriginal people with a title to the reserve lands they lived on, while providing an unspecified amount of funds to improve local services. The federal cabinet accepted the Burke proposal in lieu of its own act, and it did so without any legislative enforcement against Western Australia. This was one of the low points in the campaign for national land rights. It was also one of the rare moral low points of the Hawke government. So from 1986 onwards, I always knew that Aboriginal land rights was unfinished business. And I might say, I had the feeling that in some way, I would be called upon to deal with it. It was like one of those intractable issues, a bit like endemically high inflation, the kind that tends to follow you around. So when the High Court handed down its decision in Mabo No. 2 on the 3rd of June 1992, saying there was a concept of native title at common law, and that the source of the title was a traditional connection to or occupation of the land by Aboriginal and Islander people, I saw it as an opportunity to deal with the longest continuing problem Australia faces as a nation, the fundamental colonial grievance, the dispossession of the Indigenous people and the injustice inherent in that dispossession. By establishing that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders had a private property right to their own soil, the High Court pointed a way as to how the Parliament could deal with Indigenous land rights in a way which marked a turning point in the history between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. I thought and said at the time it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make peace between the first Australians and those who came to Australia later. I thought this pathway was a superior one to that where land was conferred upon Indigenous people by the Act of a Parliament. Here we had the High Court saying that title of an ancient kind had survived sovereignty, and to the extent that subsequent grants of interest in land were consistent with the title, the nature and content of the title could be determined by the character of the connection to or occupation of the land under traditional laws and customs. In other words, it's not ours to give you, but we recognise it as something which has always been yours. How much better. How much better, I thought, than one where a broadly non-Indigenous parliament gave land back to people who had earlier been dispossessed of it. But above all that, I saw the approach of using the High Court's native title route as possessing an even greater attribute, and that was truth. There is, especially in public life, no more beautiful a characteristic than truth. Truth is of its essence liberating. It's possessed of no contrivance or conceit. It provides the only genuine basis for progress. By overturning the lie of terra nullius, the notion that its sovereignty, the continent, was possessed by no one, the High Court not only opened a route to Indigenous land, it rang a bell which reminded us that our future could only be found in truth. This is the principal reason I found the Mabo pathway to Indigenous land so compelling. And I said so at the time in the address to celebrate the launch of the year, International Year for the World's Indigenous People, which John Rowe referred to at Redfern on the 10th of December 1992. I said in that speech, Mabo establishes a fundamental truth and lays the basis for justice. It will be much easier to work from that basis, that was from truth, than it's ever been the case in the past. In the event, virtually across all of the year 1993, and I mean 8 of the 12 months of that year, my cabinet ministers and I negotiated with Loetje O'Donoghue and her Aboriginal negotiating group to produce the Native Title Act. The Act, while necessarily complex, met two fundamental aims: justice for Aboriginal people and a workable and fair system of land management in Australia. And it did so in accordance with the Racial Discrimination Act. The preamble to the Native Title Act made clear the objectives. It said this, and I'll quote from the Act in the preamble: "The people of Australia intend to rectify the consequences of past injustices by the special measures contained in the Act, to ensure that Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islanders receive the full recognition and status within the Australian nation to which history, their prior rights and interests, and their rich and diverse culture fully entitle them to aspire." The special measures contained in the Act enabled us to determine who has native title and where. It gave native title holders the right to negotiate about actions affecting their land, and it bestowed and restored rights on them without threatening existing rights. So just 18 months after the High Court had handed down its judgment, and 1 year almost to the day after I had extolled the virtue of the common law pathway to truth and justice in the Redfern Park speech, the bill had been built and negotiated and had passed both houses of the Federal Parliament. Receiving assent on the 24th of December 1993, the Native Title Act went a substantial way in settling the fundamental grievance of Indigenous Australia, the brutal dispossession of their lands and the smashing of their ways of life at the hands of an alien imperial power. I was grateful at Gough Whitlam's kindly exclamation when he said that the unique process of the Act was a shining example of promptitude in a century-old story of procrastination. However, in a lecture in the name of someone as significant as Loetje at around the issues with which much of her public life has been associated, it's opportune to say some other things about the subject of native title and Indigenous circumstances in the broad. At the risk of repeating myself, I saw the opportunity of the native title route as a modality in dealing with and settling unresolved questions of Indigenous land justice in this country. And this brings me to an important point and one I wish to dwell on. One made by the majority of the High Court in Mabo No. 2 and illuminated in the writings of Noel Pearson. And it is this: that native title is not a creature of the common law, nor indeed is it a common law title. Rather, it is a title recognised by the common law. Or as the majority said at the time, whether the imperial common law as it existed at the time of sovereignty and first settlement, or the Australian common law as it is today. In other words, while the common law recognises a native title, native title itself did not evolve, nor did it spring from the common law. Here it's worth focusing on a refrain from the Native Title Act itself. One of its main objects is to, I quote, provide for the recognition and protection of native title. That is, those rights and interests finding their origin in Indigenous law and custom, not finding those rights and interests arising solely or peculiarly from the Act itself. Indeed, I think it's worth my taking this opportunity to say that as Prime Minister, I had always intended that native title be determined by the common law principles laid out in Mabo No. 2. That is, I saw the Native Title Act giving expression to native title as native title had evolved, in the same organic and dynamic sense that the common law itself had evolved. The common law, derived from European custom and tradition, was never frozen, nor did its development stop with Federation. Our common law didn't simply freeze in 1901, but rather continued to evolve. So too, native title should not be viewed as some museum-like strain of law, which snap frozen requires defrosting around anthropological principles, documentary records that rarely exist, if they ever existed, and an onus of proof built within rules of evidence which are calibrated so as never being able to helpfully apply. Justice Brennan in Mabo No. 2 emphasised the principles of equality in the recognition of native title. The Keating government's Native Title Act was built upon and around those principles. Yet in two important subsequent cases before the High Court, Western Australia versus Ward in 2002 and Yorta Yorta versus the State of Victoria in 2002, the court treated native title as an ordinary exercise in statutory interpretation, instead of recognising that the legislation did not seek to supersede the common law so much as to give articulation to its recognition of native title. Part and parcel of that recognition is the possibility, according to circumstances, of enlargement and flexibility. But the court chose instead the black letter route of statutory interpretation. And it did this knowing there is a body of relevant common law in the United States and in Canada and in Britain, which it cogently developed over the course of numerous decisions. In fact, the current Chief Justice, Justice French, said that in Yorta Yorta, and I quote him, he said, the High Court again emphasised the statutory definition of native title as defining the criteria that had to be satisfied before a determination could be made. He went on to say, to that extent, the court appears to have moved away from the original concept of the Act as a vehicle for the development of the common law of native title. And he went on to say this, that the court in so acting may have transformed the Act from a vessel for the development of the common law into a cage for its confinement. Earlier, I made clear that I regarded common law rights as they were revealed in Mabo No. 2 as being superior in any form to any form of statutory creation. Indeed, Section 12 of the Native Title Act made clear that the characteristics of native title under the Act were to be determined in accordance with the developing common law. Section 12, though since removed from the statute, said, and I quote it, subject to this Act, the common law of Australia in respect of native title has after 30 June 1993 the force of the law of the Commonwealth. What it said or was trying to say was that the common law, as it had developed in its native title complexion, enjoyed all the force and validity of a law of the Commonwealth. This section provided the guide as to the principles the Keating government endorsed when it constructed the Act. But Section 12 was removed from the Act after the High Court in Western Australia versus the Commonwealth in 1995 held it was invalid. But technical objections, that is legal technical objections, to the place Section 12 tried to preserve for common law flexibility do not diminish at all the high significance of the legislative attempt to promote the recognition of ownership rather than the gift of rights as the true basis for native title. It's beyond discussion that the government I led intended native title to be determined by the common law principles laid out in Mabo No. 2. I raise this issue because of the significance of the derogations from the principles as set down in Mabo No. 2 and the adoption and incorporation of those principles in the original 1993 Act. Going hand in hand with this regression is the continuing high onus of proof falling on claimants to native title. These arise from the need to establish continuity of existence of native title rights and interests on the part of claimants with reference to evidence of an anthropological kind, including archaeological and historic evidence, as well as oral evidence, as to group customary traditions and evidence as to how long such traditions have been maintained. Well, we all know that the rupture of European settlement had an atomising effect on Aboriginal society as a whole and on particular groups, such that contemporary efforts to reconstitute that society or groups within it, including the resuscitation of traditional ways, is beyond our facilities and probably our imaginations too. And this brings me back to Yorta Yorta versus the state of Victoria. In that case, the High Court held that a determination under the Native Title Act was said to be a creation of that act, not the common law. In other words, let me repeat it. In Yorta Yorta, the High Court said a determination under the Native Title Act was said to be a creation of the Native Title Act, not the common law. This is at the kernel of the problem I've just referred to, moving away from the Native Title Act as I envisage it to the snap-frozen museum variety the court subsequently came up with. Once you're working the field of literal or statutory interpretation, you're bound to satisfy more precise, or let's call it stringent, characteristics of the kind laid down in the Act for the award of title. In Yorta Yorta, the trial judge substantially lifted the bar on the whole issue of continuity. As we know, it was in southeastern Australia where the effects of European settlement were the most catastrophic and dislocatory to Aboriginal people. Despite this, the trial judge, Justice Olney, made virtually no concession to the claimants on the need to establish proof. Indeed, Justice Olney put the onus on the Yorta Yorta claimants to establish that there was a pre-sovereign society and that each generation of that society had acknowledged and observed the laws and customs of its people in a material way and uninterrupted from sovereignty to the present. As an indication of the level of difficulty this involved for the claimants in the proceedings, Olney would not concede that an Aboriginal person born in the 1840s in the area under claim had any connection with Aboriginal forebears who inhabited the same land in 1788, just 52 years earlier. Indeed, Justice Olney went out of his way to discount oral evidence by the Aboriginal claimants, preferring to rely on the written records of a squatter in the locality. In the appeal proceedings before the Federal Court, Chief Justice Black, in dissent, had this to say by way of observation. He said, "For one thing, the use of historical material to answer a claim based substantially upon an orally transmitted tradition needs to take fully into account the potential richness and strength of orally based traditions. It is necessary too, he said, to bear in mind the particular difficulties and limitations of historical assessments, not least those made by untrained observers, writing from their own cultural viewpoint and with their own cultural preconceptions for their own purposes. And he went on to observe this. He said, the external and casual viewer of another culture may see very little because the people observed may intend to reveal very little to an outsider, or because the observer may be looking at the wrong time, or because the observer may know not what to look for, or for any one of numerous other reasons. Even a conscientious attempt, he said, in past times to provide a complete record would run into difficulties of this nature. The dangers inherent in giving particular authority to the written word and more authority when it is repeated need to be borne constantly in mind. But that, those were remarks made in dissent against the majority of the federal court who upheld the Olney judgment. But no such caveat stopped the federal court and later the High Court in backing the Olney view in, notwithstanding the fact that in a number of jurisdictions abroad, in a number of countries, once proof of a pre-sovereign society has been established, courts have accepted or presumed continuity thereafter. This onerous burden of proof has placed an unjust burden on those native title claimants who have suffered the most severe dispossession and social disruption. I mean, the people in Victoria, in New South Wales, where the settled population mostly went, those communities were atomised. As a consequence, they suffered the most severe dispossession and social disruption. And of course, there can be no records, oral or otherwise, which would adequately reflect those events. It has substantially slowed the right of redress by Aboriginal people to adequate recognition of their rights in respect of land, water, and natural resources. In fact, let me give you this statistic. After 15 years operation of the Native Title Act of 1993, there have been 1,300 claims, but only 121 native title determinations, covering just over 10% of the land mass at a cost to the taxpayer of over $900 million. To ameliorate some of these constraints in the application of the substantive law where applicants are required to prove their continuity with native title, the Chief Justice Robert French, the current Chief Justice of the High Court, Robert French, had some helpful things to say actually here in Adelaide in July 2008. In those remarks, he highlighted the beneficial purpose of the Native Title Act and the beneficial purpose it seeks to confer on Aboriginal and Islander people. One of those beneficial purposes is the rectification of the consequences of past injustices. In other words, he's reminding the High Court that a purpose of the Act is a beneficial purpose, and one of the beneficial purposes is a rectification of the consequences of past injustices. Wherein, under the main objects of the Act, Section 3 seeks to provide for the recognition and protection of native title. Indeed, Justice French went on to provide a quotation from the full court in the case Northern Territory versus Aliwa in 2005. There, the court said this: the preamble of the Native Title Act declares the moral foundation upon which the Act rests. Correct. That is, to recognise, support and protect native title. And the full court went on to say this: that moral foundation and that intention stand despite the inclusion in the Native Title Act of substantive provisions which are adverse to native title rights and interests and provide for their extinguishment, permanent and temporary. So in other words, the court, another high court is reminding us that some substantive provisions within the judicial framework may operate such as to be adverse in their consequences for native title. Now, to ease the heavy requirements on claimants in respect of those substantive provisions as they go to proof and matters of continuity, Justice French suggested that some change in the Act as it relates to the onus of proof could facilitate a presumption of continuity of connection by claimants and continuity since sovereignty. Such a presumption, he said, would enable the parties, if it were not to be challenged, to disregard a substantial interruption of continuity, that is, to disregard, to put aside a substantial interruption of continuity of acknowledgement and observation of traditional laws and customs. He said, were it desired, the provision could expressly authorise disregard of substantial interruptions in acknowledgement and observance of traditional laws and customs, unless and until proof of such interruption was established. In other words, the current Chief Justice was suggesting a reverse onus of proof, where proof of any intention would need to be established. In other words, you couldn't just simply claim it, you would have to prove it. In this model, a presumption could be challenged by the respondent party, whether it be a state or a territory, but Justice French went on to say, it would be important that any presumption be robust enough to withstand the mere introduction of evidence to the contrary. That is, in other words, someone that wants to knock down this point would need to provide proof to the contrary, rather than Aboriginal and Islander people needing to provide proof themselves of their claims. His Honour's other helpful suggestion was by way of another amendment to the Native Title Act, one which would allow extinguishment to be disregarded, where an agreement was entered into between the states and the applicants that it should be disregarded. For instance, there could be a piece of Crown land which in all other respects would qualify as a native title, for native title, but maybe for 20 or 30 years it may have been given under a grant to a recreational park or a caravan park or something. But where, Justice French suggests, a state and the native title applicants agree that temporary, let's call it, extinguishment could be disregarded. Agreements of this kind, of course, go to certain goodwill and judgment by the states and territories, and we know that such a specific objective will require somewhat of a sea change on the part of a number of states and territories. As Prime Minister, the past release question was a very vexing and torrid one for me. And for this reason, notwithstanding that the Keating government's legal advice was that the Mabo judgment had the effect of extinguishing native title on lands subject to past releases, I did not agree with that advice. That is, I did not personally agree with the logic behind the advice. Many people will know how much pressure I was under as Prime Minister to clear this matter up once and for all by having the Native Title Act extinguish native title over lands subject to pastoral leases. The argument went, well, if Prime Minister, you say your best advice is that the High Court decision signalled the extinguishment of native title on pastoral leases, why don't you follow your own advice and make it certain in your native title bill? I had lots of supposedly good people urging this upon me, like the former leader of the National Party, Tim Fisher, who was doing his level best to turn pastoral leases into a quasi-freehold title at the expense of Aboriginal people. I knew there was a massive potential loss here for Aboriginal people, because in 1993, a large proportion of the land mass of Australia was subject to pastoral leases. In Western Australia, the proportion of the land mass was 38% of that state. In Queensland, 54%. In South Australia, 42%. New South Wales, 41%, and the Northern Territory, 51%. Given the scale and importance of it, I was determined not to deny Aboriginal people the chance to test this question before the High Court. So to keep the naysayers at bay and to fend off the opportunists, I decided to record in the preamble of the bill, what became the Act, that on the government's view, past leasehold grants extinguished native title. Indeed, in my second reading speech introducing the legislation, I said the following, and I quote, I draw attention also to the recording the preamble of the bill of the government's view that under the common law, past valid freehold and leasehold grants extinguished native title. There are therefore no obstacle or hindrance to renewal of past releases in the future, whether validated or already valid. So I said this in the second reading speech. I had these words in the speech and in the preamble, but I refuse to make extinguishment a fait accompli under the operating provisions of the Act. I knew that the whole idea of past releases over Crown land arose because squatters decided to move on to land for which they had no title, and where their activities, grazing or otherwise, were broadly uncontrolled. The motivation for the legislative regime, first in New South Wales in the late 1820s, was to put some control on squatters without conferring on them a freehold title to vast tracts of the country, country largely occupied by Aboriginal people. So I understood that when the various colonial and state governments came to issuing past releases, they did so knowing that the pastoral activity would occur over lands where Aboriginal people were still conducting a traditional way of life. That is, the governments issuing these leasehold titles issued them in the knowledge and acceptance of the fact that grazing could be accommodated concurrently with Aboriginal people maintaining a traditional connection with the land under grant. So when in Mabo number 2 the High Court laid down its principles, I couldn't see those principles being at odds with a coexistence of title as between pastoral activity and a traditional Aboriginal life arising from the latter's native title. I couldn't see it. In other words, I had rejected or at least held under question the Commonwealth Attorney General's Department advice that the High Court's Mabo number 2 decision and its principles effectively extinguished native title. I told officers of the Attorney General's Department at the time that I regarded their advice as black letter property advice, wherein they failed to understand how and in which ways the High Court was peering through the common law to the development of native title rights over the course of Australian history following European settlement. Putting it in the language of the lawyers, I told them that exclusive possession of land could be an incident of a pastoral lease, but in the majority of cases was unlikely to be and need not be. As it turned out, in the Wick decision of 1996, the High Court, by a majority of 4-3, held that the grant of the relevant leases did not confer on the lessees exclusive possession of the land under lease, and correctly, in my view, made clear that in the case of the Wick and the Taiwo peoples, that a relevant intention to distinguish all native title rights at the time the grants were issued was not present. That is, the grants did not necessarily extinguish all incidents of the native title rights that the Wick and Taiwo peoples enjoyed. Of course, that decision of the High Court was attacked mercilessly by the Howard government. That villain Tim Fisher boasted that there would be bucket loads of extinguishment in the High Court's response to the decision. Now, many people here, of course, will be familiar with the Sorry Tale, which became part and parcel of the Native Title Amendment Act of 1998 under the Howard government. That amendment arose from the coalition government's so-called 10-point plan, a plan facilitated in the Senate with the support of Senator Brian Harradine and under the advice of the Jesuit priest Frank Brennan. As an aside, let me say, and as a Catholic, let me say, whenever you witness the zealotry of professional Catholics in respect of Indigenous issues, invariably you find Indigenous issues subordinated to their personal notions of justice and equity, because unlike the rest of us, they enjoy some kind of divine guidance. And so it was with the Wick amendments. Point 2 of the Amending Act declared, I mean, the brazenness of it is this. Listen carefully. States and territories would be able to confirm that agricultural leases in existence on or before 1 January 1994 could be covered for exclusive tenure, to the extent it can reasonably be said that by reason of the grant or the nature of the permitted use of the land, exclusive possession must have been intended, thereby extinguishing native title. That's Little John Howard for you. And his Tory mates. The amendments were entitled Confirmation of Past Extinguishment of Native Title. But it was never clear that all freehold grants and leasehold grants permanently extinguished native title. Indeed, Mick Dodson said at the time, I quote him, by purporting to confirm extinguishment by inconsistent grants, the Commonwealth is purposely preempting the development of the common law, not allowing sufficient time to integrate the belated recognition of native title into Australia's land management system. He said, this does not require the obliteration of Indigenous interests so as to favour non-Indigenous interests. Well said, Mick Dodson. The Keating Government's Native Title Act of 1993 recognised a right to negotiate given to native title holders and a duty to negotiate vested in governments and grantees with respect of grants of mining tenements, as well as compulsory acquisition by governments for the giving of interest for a commercial purpose. The Howard Government's 1998 amendments denied the application of the right to negotiate over the great parts of Australia where native title might be established. Indeed, to probably half the mainland. The amendments removed any form of grant, many forms of grant, from the ambit of the Act, seriously diminishing the value of the Act while choking off access to native title holders. The Howard Government's 1998 amendments cut across the spirit of the Keating Government's 1993 Act, the notion that the Act was first and foremost legislation of a beneficial kind, enacted to redress historic inequities rather than to compound ones sanctioned by earlier acts. Finally, I wish to say something about another outcome in that historic negotiation between Lowitja O'Donoghue, her negotiating team, and the government I led, and that is the establishment of the Indigenous Land Corporation and Land Fund. In the course of that historic negotiation, I invited ATSIC and the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation to submit proposals for a wider package of measures to help establish an economic base for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and in establishing such a base to safeguard and further develop Aboriginal and Islander culture. That invitation and those submissions came together in what was called the Social Justice Package. A substantial element of that package was a land fund, a fund set up to support those Indigenous people dispossessed of their lands, yet unable to assert native title rights and interests. In the second reading speech of the Native Title Bill 93, I said, despite its historic significance, the Mabo decision will give little more than a sense of justice to those Aboriginal communities whose native title has been extinguished or lost, their dispossession being total, their loss complete. While these communities remain dispossessed of land, their economic marginalisation and sense of injury continue. The purpose of the fund was to acquire land and to attribute to such land a synthesised native title. In fact, I made clear that I intended that the fund could acquire pastoral leases. Of course, the farmers hated that. I didn't mind taking the money, but didn't like the idea. That intended that the fund could acquire pastoral leases and convert them to a synthesised native title. So that is, where Aboriginal people who own or acquire a pastoral lease and who the federal court determines would satisfy all other criteria for native title but for the existence of the lease and wish to convert the title to a native title, could do so. The Land Fund was the centrepiece of the Keating Government's social justice measures arising in association with the Native Title Act. The fund, which subject of its own act in 1994 became the Indigenous Land Corporation, was set up with the aim of becoming self-sustaining with over $1 billion of Commonwealth subscribed capital. The Indigenous Land Fund Act locked in those allocations to the fund and the corporation for 10 years. I designed the Act to make it extremely difficult for a future government to undo what I had put into place. I had the Attorney General's Department stitched this together with great care. As it turned out, I succeeded in making it Howard and Costello proof, vandal proof. It galled them that the ILC's budgetary appropriations were beyond their executive influence. By 2010, end of last year, appropriations of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander account stood at $1.42 billion. Payments from the land account to the Indigenous Land Corporation stood at $650 million. The ILC is now in an advantageous financial position such that it is able to expend funds on assets other than simply the purchase of land. The Land Fund and Land Corporation Initiative stands as another successful outcome from the 1993 Native Title Act negotiations led by Lowitja. Let me perhaps finish where I began. I accepted this invitation to give the Lowitja O'Donoghue Oration out of respect for Lowitja as a remarkable person and a leader of Aboriginal people. As I said earlier, her unfailing instinct for enlargement marks her out as a person of great significance in the Australian political firmament. I like to think that together, she and I were able to lead our respective political forces towards an historic outcome for a race of people dispossessed and decimated by the process of settlement. Without having been lobbied or cajoled, I took the opportunity of the Redfern Park speech in 1992 to lay out openly and truthfully the history of our inhumanity towards and thoughtless disregard of Australia's Indigenous people. For the nation's integrity and moral clarity, I thought it necessary it face up to the truths of our colonial history. Similarly, I saw the Mabo decision and the Native Title Act as an opportunity to transcend the history of that dispossession, to put right an historic wrong, an opportunity to restore the age-old link between Aboriginal land and culture, to declare Aboriginal culture a defining element as to who we are, and to make clear that our spiritual enlargement as a people could best be accomplished when that enlargement includes a secure and prosperous place for the first Australians. Lowitja O'Donoghue has been and remains an important part of this national transformation, and this oration in her name is testimony to that reality. Thank you indeed.